In the Navy, we said that to be early is to be on time is to be late, and to be late is to be hosed, but we're on time, so at least we're only late. Good evening, Representative Mark Sauter and Jim Woodward here. I appreciate you coming out. I was trying to come up with some kind of good joke to let you know you were being tested, and you've all passed the test because you're here on a Saturday evening competing with good weather. But I didn't come up with a good joke. I just had the thoughts. So we tried. And I do appreciate all of you being out here. We'll talk just say a few thank yous to some folks who've been helping out so much. And then we do have Chief Armstrong with Selkirk Fire here, and we'll let him come up and have a few minutes to talk with you. And then we'll go on to that legislative piece that we promised you here this evening. So I do want to say thank you and point out and make sure everyone knows there are lots and lots of refreshments, because we had two enthusiastic groups make cookies. One is my cousin's daughter made a whole bunch of cookies, I think 18 dozen. And then Mike Mooney here has been is our treasurer and has been with the campaign since 2018. And his wife Nancy, who's not here, also made a lot of cookies. So everybody should leave on a sugar high. But the coffee, I understand, I think it's decaffeinated. Maybe they're both back there, but so we won't make you stay up all night. We'll just let you go home happy on sugar. So who else am I supposed to say thank you to, Bev? I mean, Andy and Bev, of course. You know, Bev's in the back, and I refer to her as, I mean, she is my aunt, so it's Aunt Bev. But she came down to the Capitol this year, and now everybody in the Capitol, or many people in the Capitol, also know her as Aunt Bev. It's kind of funny. So thanks for people being here. We do have Mayor Eskridge, so we should acknowledge elected officials. And I'm scanning who else. We have former Commissioner Sudik. And do we have any other elected officials here in the room? Maybe not. But appreciate everyone being here. So I'll let Mark introduce himself.
Hi, I'm Mark Sauter. Thank you all for being here. I'll be succinct as possible, but I do want to thank Andy Key, and I don't think his dog's here in the room right now, but I certainly appreciate Andy, and he certainly is a part of why we're here. He wanted to throw it out that he'd set up everything again for us to do a wrap-up for all of you, because he helped us with the VFW stuff for our three meet and greets. So thanks, Andy, and Tyler as well. So thank you. Chief, you want to come up? While Chief's coming up, essentially we have three parts, four parts tonight. You've got a fire briefing, and then we'll talk about, a little bit about Idaho politics, give you a little short rundown on what happened during session and what we're working on in the recess, if you will. So with that, Chief.
I just want to say that second word there, you hear that oftentimes, sine die, and that's what we talk about in the Capitol, but we go back and forth. That is Latin, sine die, which is to adjourn with no set date. And so that middle term there, sine die, I mean, that's what we do in the Capitol, and you'll hear everybody refer to sine die. When are we going to sine die? How is this going to happen? But that's what the middle term is there. And we did up on the top there, we're not stuck to any format. Ask questions whenever you want, but we've kind of set this up so we'll talk a little bit and then take questions on, and then we'll move on after the questions. And so Andy has a microphone and we can have people talk, but that's kind of what we thought for a format, was just to let everybody ask questions as they come up instead of trying to hold questions. So you're welcome to ask anytime. We'll let Chief Armstrong go at it. Just so folks know, I've had a...
This is the third time.
<This time. laughs> I served on the Segal Fire Board for 7 years and so got the opportunity to work with Chief Armstrong, so I'm happy to have him here this evening. Thank you, Chief.
Are we sure? Thank you. So, however you pronounce that, I thought that's what was going to happen to me after I spilt Mark's coffee. So I was coming through the kitchen, and I moved to get out of somebody's way, and I bumped a cardboard box, and Mark's coffee went off the end of the counter. And it was caffeinated, so now he has to drink the decaffeinated. Sorry, Mark. I wanted to own that. I said, what an entrance to an event. Thank you very much for having me here. Thank you very much for the opportunity to stand in front of you for a few minutes. I have three objectives tonight. I'd like to give you some factual information. I'd like you to be able to ask me the tough questions and get the answers directly from me, because there's a lot floating out there, and I want you guys to have the facts and the information from me the best I can present it. And number three would be to let you know a little bit more about your fire protection and your fire districts if you live in one of the three fire districts. So quickly, a brief introduction of me. I see a lot of faces that I've seen before. My name is Jeff Armstrong, and I serve as the fire chief for the Sagal, Westside, and Northside fire districts. Last year, when the city of Sandpoint and the fire districts went in their separate direction, I fell into the fire chief's position for Sagal and Westside, which is Selkirk Fire. At the same time, the Northside fire chief was retiring, and Northside, I lived in their district, and I just reached out to him and said, hey, do you need help in the interim? Do you want help recruiting a fire chief? And that kind of blossomed into me helping them on incidents, helping them administratively, and ultimately signing a contract and sharing a fire chief. So all three fire districts are seeing a cost savings by having me as a fire chief. I'm seeing a workload increase. But that's okay, I'm happy to do it. So why a fire levy? So the conversation happened long before I became fire chief. There was already some discussion about where we need to be in the fire service and what are we doing and what's the future look like. So I got handed that task, and I had to sit down and present to my bosses, the 11 elected officials that I serve for, what do you need? And I said, I need equipment and people, or I need to reprioritize and have a strategic plan going forward, because our equipment is old, and we need to understand if we have the right number of firefighters. At the same time, we're having a decline in volunteerism, and so we really needed to address that either through a program enhancement or through hiring more firefighters. So I presented a plan to the commissioners, and they, through a series of meetings, studies, community outreach, we did a community survey, came up with and vetted that plan and had some direction with that plan. So really what we're looking at is, anybody in here surprised Bonner County's grown? It's grown, right? With that has come some growth and some demand on emergency services. Now, I look at stats, and I see data that says 20 to 27% over the last 10 to 20 years. Depending on what source you looked at, it's a little bit different. Our call volume hasn't grown 27%, but our call volume is increasing. I did hear some stats from the sheriff saying that over the last 10 years there's a 200 and... want to say they said 240, and that sounds too much, but it was about a 200% increase in traffic accidents. We respond to traffic accidents, right? So I'm trying to sit down and look at our data, and we don't have the best data going back 20 years ago, but we have some solid data for the last 3 years, and I see some trends. And as your fire chief, it's my job to make sure that I have the resources to be able to protect you, send the right number of firefighters to your house immediately when you call 911 or immediately thereafter and get them there as quickly as possible. Can't fight geography, right? So response times isn't anything that I can necessarily work with. So I sat down and I put a plan together, assuming it's Sally Advance. And for the three districts, I took a look at their service level, their resources, because even though the three districts are working together, sharing me, Sagal and Westside are in a JPA, each district is paying for its level of service. So I looked at some of the trends in the fire districts, and I laid out a vision for what the future could look like. And now we're going to end up on May 20th posing a question to the voters: is this something that you support going forward? So in Sagal Fire District, which is 175 square miles, we have a total of 5 fire stations. Of those, currently 2 are staffed with paid firefighters. One of the struggles we're having is with the cost of overtime to keep the Kerrywood Fire Station staffed. So one of my proposals in here is to increase the number of firefighters by 2 per day, which would allow me to move firefighters around and not create such a large impact on our overtime budget. We would also allocate some equipment money. That would free up some money that we could allocate towards equipment, because we're spending less on overtime. And it would also allow us to carve out some money to start saving for either a fire station remodel or a relocation if the highway expansion goes through. Over in the Westside Fire District, currently we have 1 firefighter on a day. And over attrition and over the years, the volunteerism program has really
quite honestly gone away. And I'm working on resurrecting that, and we've brought some more volunteers on, but it takes time to build those ranks up. So right now when you call 911, one firefighter is going out the door in a fire engine. That's something that I struggle with, and that's something that I would like to fix, either through the potential levy ask or through a volunteerism program in the future. I would like to see, for safety purposes, to have two people on that fire engine. So the ask over there is a steep one, because we're going from one person a day to we would potentially be going to three people a day. So that ask is a little bit more. That would, we would be adding a total of six firefighters. If you do the math, two on each shift, and we run three shifts. And then we would create a savings account, $150,000 a year for fire engine. New fire engines are about $1 million. About 10 years ago, they were 700,000, somewhere around there. Mark, when you started in the fire service, they were probably a couple hundred thousand. So, you know, just like everybody, we're seeing the cost of doing business is going up. And what we don't have really in the fire districts is a really solid strategic plan. So I'm starting to craft that and put that together. And right now I'm identifying the need for a fire engine in about 5 to 7 years. And so $150,000 in a savings account in 5 to 7 years would give us a really good number to be able to buy something that was in really good shape, decent and used. Over in the Northside Fire District, one of the things we heard from our community feedback was they wanted a decrease in response times. And a lot of folks were concerned about the upper end of the fire district near the Samuels Fire Station. So when we sat down and we took a look at what that levy would be, it would not only absorb the grant position that we currently have in Ponderay, but it would also add two paid firefighters up at the Samuels Station. And then they have some other maintenance and operations just like the other districts do that we would want to allocate some money for that. There is material at the back on the table. I'm not going to force it on you, but it's back there if you want to grab it. There's a flyer. There's, if somebody's buying something, they want to know what they're buying. And so there's a breakdown of the budget numbers of where this levy would go and how it would be allocated. There's some fact sheets on each of the three districts, so make sure when you look, they're in stacks. Make sure you grab the right district depending on where you live, or you can grab them all if you're interested. And then I think there's a couple other little informational pieces back there just because obviously we want folks to know. So the big thing for me is I want to start connecting with the community. Regardless of a levy discussion, I don't feel like the fire districts have been out enough in the community. I don't feel like a lot of folks understand what we do. They drive by, they see a fire station, and that's a fire station. There must be people there. And so I want to, for the next couple years, my commitment to the community is to continue to be engaged, to be educational, to make sure we bring a value added to the community. So with that, that's the end of my presentation. My contact information is up there. If you want to grab your camera, zoom in. More than happy to respond on email or by phone. And questions, yes? So there's a lot of people telling me online how it affects me. I don't know. I haven't dug into the bill. And quite honestly, I don't have those discussions with my elected officials right now. The elected officials are posing a question to you in the form of the levy override because they're looking at the service level in each individual district. Depending on whether they pass, whether they fail, whether one passes, one doesn't fail, it's going to complicate the conversation going forward. So that is actually something that I haven't dove into. I went to the bill and I read the bill because it was posted online that's why we were asking for the levies. And I said, oh, okay, I didn't know that. And so I went and read the bill to kind of understand a little bit more. One of the things that I would have to get through is not all these districts touch. So I don't really know how that works. I don't know what that looks like, that approval process. So I'm not dodging the question. I just don't actually know, and my elected officials on the Fire Commission Board have not directed me to start looking at that. So we've resurrected the program, and what we've done is we've modified our training program and set them up with mentors. So instead of saying you have to be here Tuesday and Thursday night and every other Saturday, we found a creative way for them to come in and hang out with their mentor when their mentor's working and get their hours done on their schedule at their convenience. The continual problem of volunteerism comes from response times, availabilities, people life's busy. They don't have 500 hours to devote to being trained to be a firefighter. So our numbers are still going to continue to be challenging, But right now we recruited three, and we have another four in the pipeline that we're getting ready to hire. And they're going to be great folks on a Saturday when there's a fire. But a Tuesday afternoon, you know, I just need to have real conversations with the public about what a volunteer program is going to look like. Because when you call 911 and a volunteer has to drive 10 minutes to the fire station, then get on a rig and come out, you know, what I'm looking for is I'm looking to be able to show up to your call with the initial firefighters out the door and what I would call an effective response force. I want an operationally effective number of firefighters to show up at your house when it's on fire so that I can get this list of tasks done in the first 10 minutes of being there. Because if I don't get those done, then my chances of saving your home go down. Yes? 18. So I have, and the high school's interested. The problem is I have to vet that through my insurance. So if we're talking minors, I have to have people that are specially trained. I have to have releases. I have to have special insurance. The school probably has some money they can allocate towards that. But with everything that's else that I've been dealing with, from the exit from Sandpoint to reestablishing the JPA to working with Northside, it is on my radar to do. I haven't gotten to it. So thank you. And just so you guys know, I have an admin, but I don't have battalion chiefs. I don't have deputy chiefs. I don't have anything else. I have the guys on the fire engine and me, and that's it. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes, thank you for that. Out at Bottle Bay in the Sagal Fire District, we have a resident firefighter, and he lives out there. He also works full-time for Northside Fire. So when he's at work for Northside Fire for his 2 days, he's unavailable. But on his days off, he's in Bottle Bay, and he's a resident firefighter. That is another example of a creative volunteer program where we got creative, and we said, okay, how can we bring people into a department and make it lucrative for them, right? Free rent is pretty lucrative. So we found somebody, and that's a unique niche, right, of somebody that's interested in that. So thank you for bringing that up. I appreciate it. Yes, you had a question.
That was my question.
Oh, perfect. And I believe I have another meeting out in that area tomorrow at the church. Yes. That's it? Oh, you got to ask me the hard questions. Got to be some tough ones. Yes, sir. You look like a tough question guy. You did not disappoint on the tough question. I called that one. If that is something that, you know, they're a district, so there's an opportunity for us, right, to work with them. If there was an organic desire from the community to explore that, I'm not opposed to that. Even if it meant that I didn't get to be the head honcho. I'm completely fine with that. Anything we can do to make sure we have the right resources and we protect the community better, I'm open to it. That's a complicated one, only because of the district size, the ambulance district size. I did broach the subject of potentially cross-training them, since, you know, we do go to medical aides to help them. Maybe they could cross-train. I think right now they've got a lot on their plate, but that's something. Any opportunity to continue to build a relationship with EMS, because it hasn't been the best relationship, but continuing to build that relationship and find ways to work together is always, I'm always open to it. That one, I don't think I can hit the Staples easy button on that one though. Yes, sir. The rating? Yeah. Now we're getting into the good questions. That one's a tough one, and it sounds like I'm not wanting to give you a straight answer, and that's not what. There's just so much about that I don't know because it's proprietary to the insurance companies. 10, 15, 20 years ago, they used to rely a lot more heavily on the ISO or the ISRB rating. ISRB is a company or is an organization that comes in and evaluates the fire departments. And they look at your operation, they give you a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the worst, 1 being the best, and they match you up against national standards. So that's where you hear people start talking about NFPA and things like that. We're currently sitting at a 5 in Northside and a 4 in Sagal and Westside. I have a concern with Westside, because one of the first things they look at is, can you get 4 firefighters to a fire? And without a robust volunteer program and without more firefighters, and I need to rebuild that program, we're going to struggle to be able to do that. So I have some concerns there. Now, I can't answer the question and say, well, if you pass this levy, your insurance will go down. I can't say that because there's so many other factors, up to and including everything else that's going on in other states right now. We have an insurance crisis coming. I just read an article today about insurance companies pulling out of the state of Idaho. So we have a problem. My job as your fire chief is to do everything I can to make sure the fire service isn't one of your problems, and that's what I'm trying to do. Okay.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Just for... just for clarity on that question about the legislation this year, the legislation was in regards to consolidation of fire districts, something that Representative Sauter put together because of his lifelong experience in that. And this is in regards to the amount of funding. So two different topics, really. That there's not a question in front of the people about consolidating fire districts together, and that legislation was fixing a problem in regards to the financial end of merging two different taxing districts. And this, of course, is just asking, do you want to have more, do you want to have those firefighters at the Kerrywood Station, at the Westwood Station, the west side? So two different questions. So.
Okay, we're transitioning here. I think all of you know a little bit about the makeup of our legislature, but we thought it would be important to at least show you real quick. Obviously, 35 legislative districts, that's a constitutional issue. We've had that for years. But we thought it would be important to show that if you look, you know, we're from my hand and up. So as far as the amount of influence we have, if you look at our five northern districts, there's 15 of us. That's not a lot when it's compared to 105 people in the Capitol. So we do our best to get things done, but you can see the scope. It's a big old state, and George Eskridge is here. He was here before me. I'm not sure if I sit in your seat, if you were 1A or 1B, but anyway, my point here is when George was in, there was a team of legislators that represented District 1, and I've been reminded of that by people that I don't even know in the Capitol. But when the people in your district come in and the legislators come in and work as a team and a group, you can get just a little more done. And when you're making points, it adds up and it's helpful. So, but real quick, the other issue that we have is when we get down to the Capitol, we all have assignments. Jim is been, and I'll let Jim talk about his committees, but you get assigned to different committees that you work on. So you work on the committees, and then you always have what's called the floor sessions. And those go lots of different schedules and lots of different times. But early on, you don't meet on the floor as often. Towards the end, you meet on the floor almost all day, it seems like. But typically, you get three committee assignments. If you're on JFAC, you get sometimes it's two. For me, I have education, agriculture, and resources. So I think all three of those are important for our district. We ask for the committees that we get. We are assigned to. We don't always get what we ask for, just like everybody else. So, and then finally, we come back to our district. We're here for about 9 months out of the year. We're home. So, with that, I'll Jim, I know you have a little bit. You have some stuff to say too.
Mark, what? I don't remember your committee assignments. Education. Education, agriculture, and resources, natural resources. So those are the three committees Mark has. I ended up with two again this time. You're going backward. I've already been using it. Yeah, I don't. God. Yeah, so I'm on the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee and Education Committee. So we meet daily on JFAC. It takes enough time that I'm glad to just have the two committees. But I saw some of that this year. I think that's all I needed to cover on that one. This is kind of an interesting piece that shows just what the makeup is in the legislature. So we're looking at the pie chart on the left, the hat for the House, and the pie chart on the right for the Senate. And you can see that distinction. But there's really one line on here that we haven't shown, which is that division in the red. And that we really have essentially two groups in the Senate, and pretty much follows the same in the House. And it's just about balance right now. The votes, you know, if you look at a caucus vote where we have 29 senators who are Republicans, then that vote oftentimes between the two groups is 14 to 15 or 15 to 14. And so I think that just the point there to emphasize is what it does for the Republican leadership is that sometimes they're walking on eggshells because they're trying to work with two different groups, and that's a challenge, that divided caucus. And I don't have to, everybody in here understands it. So I'll pass on saying anything more so I don't get quoted. But then the chart on the right really shows those concentrations of the different legislators, in particular showing that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted the pointer here, but you know, Kootenai County has a pretty strong contingent of one ilk. And then down here in Ada and Canyon, there's a pretty strong concentration there too in the western side of Boise, or west of Boise. But that's what we're showing here. We've seen these different trends of how the legislature or the representatives and senators who are sent to the legislature made up so you notice over here in eastern Idaho that there aren't that many red dots showing the what we'll call the people who are further to the right on the political spectrum. And that's, I would say that essentially that wave has come and gone. And if you see, wrong button again, but down here in the Magic Valley, these are a couple of new red dots here that weren't here before. The Magic Valley is interesting because the voter turnout is a lot lower than what we have here. Where we're getting upwards of 50% in a primary, I've seen voter turnout down there well below 20%, and so they kind of got caught off guard this year. They had an out-of-state funded effort, and many of their traditional Idaho Republican legislators lost their elections, and that's what we're showing in those two red dots right there and right there in the Magic Valley, that there was those are some fresh on the far side of the spectrum. So I think Mark and I can both talk about this one for a minute. I'll hit a couple of them. But I just wanted, we've got, when we talk about inside the Capitol and who is there, who are we talking to on a daily basis, we sometimes use the word lobbyist. We also say legislative. What's the other term? Anyhow, the groups, lots of groups throughout Idaho send people to represent their interests. And so on the left-hand side of this, we've broken that down. The Association of Commerce and Industry, which is essentially the Chamber of Commerce, but on a statewide level, and representing many of the bigger businesses in the state of Idaho, Western States Caterpillar, Idaho Forest Group, Amalgamated Sugar, Micron, all those larger businesses in the state of Idaho. And then Association of Cities, like Sandpoint, Dover, they're all members of the Association of Idaho Cities. Farm Bureau, some of these you recognize. And then we do have these other groups now. We put up there on the top that Make Liberty Win / YAL. That's the Young Americans for Liberty.
If you remember at the beginning of the legislative session, many of us received a postcard talking about getting rid of the grocery sales tax, that we should get rid of it versus what we do now where we give you a credit back, but we still collect grocery tax from all the people coming in on the, as tourists. And that was an effort there that YAL, so they're out of Texas, because if you saw that postcard, if you looked at that closely, the return address was Texas. And so that was a group from Texas trying to tell us what to do here in Idaho, in our policy. And if you go down through this list, you'll see a number of examples where there's outside money coming in. But I wanted to give this list. We can talk a little bit more and answer questions on it, but I think Mark's got some comments to make too.
Thanks, Jim. The Iaki group, I think their claim to fame is they represent about 2/3 of the employees in the state. That's how many employers and how big the employers are that Iaki speaks for. So big group, and if you add that to the Farm Bureau, all of a sudden that's a pretty big segment of the population as far as our workforce goes. And then the Make Liberty Win, Young Americans for Liberty, that's a group that came into Twin Falls and actually changed the elections around quite a bit. They think they were successful in getting 5 or 6 representatives and senators elected in the Magic Valley, Twin Falls area. They actually brought people in, paid for their housing or their hotels and meals, and they actually did door knocking for new candidates. So that was a big difference and a big change in the makeup of the Capitol this year. So that kind of out-of-state money makes a difference, especially in a low turnout situation. And then there's Citizens Alliance of Idaho, the Freedom Foundation you hear quite a bit about, but I thought it was interesting to try and compare these. We all hear about a Freedom Foundation and a scoring mechanism, but they're not the only ones that do that. I added the Idaho Children or Primary group because they score representatives too. And so does Iaki, and just lots of groups keep track on all of your votes. So it's just a matter of how much influence they may have in the way you vote. I like to say that you vote for your district, but some people don't see it that way. So, and Mountain States Policy Center, it feels like they're out of Coeur d'Alene, but they also speak for Washington, Idaho, Montana. They'll typically report on different issues that are happening in the other states as well. So it's another influential group that tries to influence how elected officials may vote. So anyway, and it's not meant to be red or a blue line there on the screen. It's just that there's a lot of influences. But I do want to make one point in, and that is, to me, the most important lobby interest group there is they're in the room. For me, I like to call home. I mention it when I'm on the floor debating, even when I'm in any of our committees. But when you can call home or you get the word from home that we're having a problem with this. For instance, we had a bill that talked about license plates on the front of cars. That sounds pretty innocuous and maybe not a big deal, but both of our sheriffs took the time to text me about that and said it was really important to them, and I voted against the bill. So that kind of local influence, or the fire bill we can talk about later, but all of those different issues are local influences. When there's an issue with our medical health care system, I'm calling our hospital. When it comes up for medical education, I got an email from one of our local doctors long before it ever hit as a bill in the Capitol, giving me a warning. Hey, there's a bill coming that's going to impact our medical training, so you need to be on the lookout for it. And then I spent some time with the doctor talking to him, about an hour. So to me, that's the most influential lobby group. It's home. But that doesn't work for everybody. Not everybody sits down with their school superintendents and has a good dialogue with them to do that. But that's how, to me, that's how it should work. That's the best way we can I can represent all of you. So
the other comment I'd make on that list on the right is that most of those organizations ask for you to pledge to them. they come up with a set of criteria, and then they want you to pledge. The Citizens Alliance of Idaho is one that came out. Matt Edwards showed up out of California, and I met with him 4 years ago, and they had a list, and then they just said it: if you pledge to follow these, then we will support you in your campaign. If you don't pledge to agree to our principles, then we're going to actively oppose you. And so I find that a little bit offensive, because we're not going to agree with everyone any time, and especially when someone who's just moved here. What turns out, it's a little bit worse than that. If you look at the last primary cycle, the Citizens Alliance of Idaho, I think they spent about $480,000 in the primaries here in the state of Idaho. And you could just watch their campaign fund balance. Anytime they got low, then another $20,000 or $30,000 or $50,000 came from Virginia. And so, is that Idahoans making Idaho decisions? That's what we're trying to share here. I don't want to just say, I'm not trying to complain to you, but I want to let you know what is going on, that Idaho has become somewhat of a petri dish for a political experiment, and we need to make sure that we maintain control of our decisions here in the state of Idaho. That line there, the Gang of Eight, that's the self-proclaimed title of eight legislators who have chosen to align and follow Make Liberty Wins ideals, which is a libertarian organization out of Texas. They committed to, so how does that play out in the legislature? So they committed to not support any budget bill that had a growth of 1.2% or greater. Is that realistic? If the budgets reflect what's going on in Idaho, one, you have to take into account inflation, and two, growth, population growth. And so are the budgets going to grow less than 1.2%? And the answer is no. That's not the reality. And so we have on the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee, we have 10 House members and 10 Senate members. And one of the Senate members I work with, she's in part of the Gang of Eight and is committed not to vote for any budget bill that's greater than 1.2%. Well, we have about 100 budget bills that we need to develop in the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee, vote on them, at least get a majority in the committee, and then somebody has to take that bill and go to the floor and present that bill as the floor sponsor and get that bill through the floor, so it can go on to the other chamber and then to the governor and become law to pass a budget. That's what we do here in Idaho, right? We pass a balanced budget every year. But if you've committed that you're not going to vote for any budget greater than 1.2% and you vote no on every budget in committee, then you don't take any budgets to the floor. So how are you picking up your share of the load? So of those 10, I said we had 10 Senate members and we had about 100 bills we had to carry. And so that person in the Gang of Eight carried one bill out of 100. And most people would carry the average of 10, right? But so that meant that most people were carrying 11 or 12. As vice chair of the committee, I ended up carrying 17 instead of 10, right? And so that's another part of this, is this reality? And if you have the privilege of serving on the finance committee, where you get to help shape these decisions, you need to actually participate, not just go there and be the no person. It just doesn't work. I say over and over, two key components of our success here in Idaho are a balanced budget and a citizen legislature, where we go home and work again and live under the laws that we helped to write. And so if you go there and just say no, then you're not working toward that balanced budget. And we had the comment about the roads and the danger of the roads, and I've been trying to address that. We've talked already with IT, with Transportation Department and ISP this year about emphasis patrols, but what we need to be able to do is make the investments in the road, and we'll talk a little bit more about budget, and you'll see we've reduced our investments in transportation and infrastructure this year. So did anybody get the little subtle jab that this was called Idaho Fireplace Forum? Great. because the Freedom Foundation, I poked back and forth. I mean, there are some people in the Capitol that I don't agree with, but at least we really jab each other all the time. So that was, I was just having a little bit of fun with that. Oh, let's see. Go ahead. Yeah, question.
Do they have a response when you say you're not holding up your end of the deal? You're not sure. Representing the people that sent you here?
Yeah, they do.
Do you have any kind of response?
Oh, well, like that Citizens Alliance, what they do, their response is, comes during the primary in what's in your mailbox. Yeah, that's so.
Or they may, you know, they may send, you may get 2 to 3 dozen voicemails, angry ones, or lots of emails saying that you're not, you know, you're not conservative, or you're not voting the way that they think you should vote, and asking you to explain your vote. So that happens as well. So the feedback, sometimes it's pretty quick, it's within a day. Other times it takes a little more time. Other times it's at the primary. But yeah, you get feedback. So, and lots of times it's not from people that are at home. Lots of times I'm in the habit of asking people, so what area of the state do you live in? And oftentimes they'll just avoid saying that. Sometimes they will. And for me, that's usually the game changer. It's like, okay, well, I'm not going to talk to much, spend a lot of time with someone from Pocatello when there's someone from Sandpoint that I need to talk with.
So we want to share with you one way to look at the end of the session and see what really has gone on, both from a budget perspective and policy. And this CINEDI or CINEDA report, we have a few hard copies in the room for folks to look at. And if you can take those when we're done, the 4 of them or so that are out there. But of course, it's available online. And it goes through and just gives you a good summary of what has happened during a legislative session. It gives you the big overall numbers in the budget. So this is an interesting trend we're seeing in the state right now. If you look at, we have red on the bottom, green and yellow, and the red number is the number of bills actually enacted into law. And so you can see 329, 341, 364, right there just above 300. It's staying pretty constant. A lot of those are budget bills. But what we're starting to add to are the number of bills that are introduced, or the first step really, the number of bills that are, it says RS, a routing slip. And so the bills that are printed, you can see that trend line that we're starting to be a little more prolific in the amount of legislation that's coming out. It's like every idea is a good idea. But you can see there's a little bit of a trend line too in the number of bills that are getting going on into the committee process, but maybe not becoming law. So this goes back to the comment about a citizen legislature, because the more bills we're going to work on, the longer it takes. And so we're trying to figure out, there are many of us who are interested in figuring out how to limit how many bills we want to take a look at every year. We have 105 people who are elected and have that opportunity to go and represent the people. And so that's a balance between making sure that everybody gets their chance. But we saw some people come in with one representative in particular had 50 different ideas and another had 70. And so if everybody came in with an average of 60 ideas, that would be over 6,000 pieces of legislation. We'd be there all year. And so we're going to have to come up with something. We have to talk about, do we just plain limit how many pieces each legislator can bring? Or we talked about, when you have the House and the Senate, how many bills can transfer from one to the other so that leadership in each chamber can prioritize a little bit, force some prioritization. But it's bigger government if we're going to do this more and more and more. And so what we saw was an effort this year to add one more attorney to our bill drafting staff so we could do more of these ideas. I managed to kill that twice in JFAC, and so we won't be dealing with, or we're not going down that route. We need to come up with a way to just figure out how to make sure we get all the ideas. We'll start back there with Tyler. Go ahead, Tyler.
Trying to turn Idaho into a petri dish, and I'm wondering what kind of out-of-state legislation you're seeing try to get introduced, and is there a way to analyze it or track it, and like, what's the source behind this?
You want to touch on that one? You talked about
that the other day. Sure. Yes, it happens. Right now, there's no tracking of it. Where the legislator goes into the legislative services office to get a bill drafted, they can just simply bring in a bill that's already drafted from another state, Mississippi, Wisconsin, you name it. They can bring it in. They can get it changed around, get the numbers right with our statutes and our system. But it largely is a bill from another state. We are aware, and it's well known that there are national forums for legislators to attend, and they get some legislators are sponsored to go, and these different groups will have bills of certain, for whatever reason, whether it's family policy or education or private schools or whatever, and out of those come bills that are ready to go, quote, that all they need to do is submit them to get them kind of localized. So that certainly does happen. This year I've started asking in committee, did you write this bill? Or who wrote this bill? To try and have it as an open-ended question. You get some interesting answers. But there's some bills that are homegrown and other bills that come from, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 miles away. And then also depending on the makeup of the legislature, this year I heard there were a number of bills that here people actually confiding and saying, we've been trying to get a bill like this passed for 8 years. And it's you know, such and such a state has made it work. We've changed them around, we've redrafted them, and we think we're finally now, we have the votes to get something through. So it's not like every one of the bills that we see is written over the summer and it comes in and it lands in January at the Capitol. Some of these are resurrected. There's stories of people with files that go back years and years because they couldn't get a bill passed before. So it just doesn't go away. So, yes, ma'am.
There is an increase of outsiders coming in and writing those laws and bringing them into Idaho, that they're not being generated from inside of our state and with our citizens.
Yes. There certainly is a segment of the bills that are introduced from other places, yes.
And so besides having to manage all of that on your end with that type of question, is there anything else that you can do or that we can do as citizens to prevent that, in your opinion?
I'm not sure if citizens would know on their own where bills came from and what bills would be introduced. The process is most of the bills are not public until they hit the committee for the first time. That's when you can see them online and read them. So as far as a citizen goes, as a legislator, yes, I talked about it this session and I'll probably bring something next. I'd like to have a cover page to where there'd be something about the legislator that's bringing it and that there'd be some history on where the bill came from. And I think that's a fair question, and just put it in writing. And if you have to have it, you know, notarized or whatever, but the history matters, I think, so.
I just want to add to that. The free flow of ideas between states is a good thing because we have good ideas come to Idaho. And so we want to look and consider ideas, but when we have people who are simply have prescribed to a group and they're going to do as told, then we've got the wrong people in the building. And so that's back to the election process. But I think Mary's ready to go next.
Yes, two things. One is we're looking at a proliferation of government. This is growing government by leaps and bounds, and I think citizens can do something. The other thing citizens can do is House Resolution 18, which was advanced by one of your colleagues. I've read it twice. This is a transparency in government bill or resolution. I'd like to see the Senate entertain something along those lines, because when I read the statement of purpose for a bill, first of all, this year was a change. Some of this stuff wouldn't pass middle school English. So there are some internal rulemaking things that need to be dealt with. But every statement of purpose should have the source, the primary origin of the bill. And the citizens demand this. We want to know where our bills are coming from. This would be a step in the right direction. Insist that House Resolution 18 gets legs this next session. That's what I would encourage.
Thanks, Mary.
I was scrambling on the screen there to find House Resolution 18, because in the Senate I had never seen House Resolution 18, because it was not a concurrent. If you look at this list of legislation, if it says HCR, that's a concurrent resolution, which means it starts in the House, comes to the Senate for if it passes the House, and opposite is true, a Senate concurrent resolution. But so House Resolution 18 was introduced right toward the end of the session, and it was this idea of limiting legislation. But yeah. So you heard me. I'm in agreement. Were there some more questions? Yeah.
It just goes back to what a couple of people were saying, this individual back here. Although we probably can't and maybe shouldn't limit ideas from outside the state, it would be nice to maybe have some sort of a means of information and educating the public as to who these entities are, where they come from, and so that people can make their own decisions. Because sometimes I feel like I see all this stuff and I feel, who is this person? And I hear social media is really bad for hearing, you know, all sorts of things, and you just don't know what's true and what isn't. And it would be nice if we had some way of maybe quantifying who these entities are, so we can make that choice ourselves.
Well, it does take a little bit of research, time and research. You know, we're dealing with it all the time. And that's why we're trying to share some of this, just to introduce the idea. But all of these organizations have websites, and so you can go, and you have to be able to filter through their public presentation of themselves a little bit. But that's being involved and understanding. So that's what we're trying to do. Yep. On to the next one.
I can wait. It's okay.
Well, we promised. Oh, did you have another question?
I did.
Go ahead.
When you guys come back into session, are you possibly thinking about putting some, I guess, penalties into effect for the flag law, like the one that's going on in Boise right now?
No, I'm certainly not. You know, that flag law affected us in this district because, and I debated against that on the floor. Boundary County, as long as I can remember, and I grew up there in the 70s, we had the Canadian flag flying because Boundary County, City of Bonner's Ferry is a border town. And so the U.S. flag and the Canadian flag flying there as you come across the bridge into town. And I didn't think they were going to, but I'm told that they got a notification from the Attorney General and that they since have pulled the flag down. And that I asked the bill sponsor on the floor about it, that scenario, and he had a mumbled response about it shouldn't be a problem. But
maybe like put some sort of like amendment on it to.
Yeah. So that's an example of a bill that's coming from a bill mill. That's what we refer to as a bill mill. That's not something that someone generated on. It was not Idaho solutions for Idaho problems. That's my guiding principle. And that's not what we're seeing in a lot of these. It's just some people think that by the more bills they pass, the more they're doing. But if there's not a problem, then we don't need to necessarily pass legislation. We can pass a budget and go home. Government is overhead, right? A lot of times. So going on, this is one of the, this is a budget summary. And so looking up in the upper right corner here, governor's recommendation, and then actually what came out of the legislature. Revenues
and then appropriations. And I wanted to show this because I've talked about this a little bit. I've written about it and told people about it, but this chart really kind of shows it. We made some decisions up here in the top this year. We came into the legislative session talking about $100 million in tax relief. That was going to be split. The original idea was splitting that $50 million for income tax and then $50 million for property tax. The action was $253 million in income tax relief. So that's $250 million that's not available for roads, other infrastructure. So that was a large income tax cut, much larger than what was originally talked about and anticipated in the budget process. Going down a little bit, this one actually is a good policy choice. If you're selling less than $5,000, you're at the farmer's market or something like that, you don't have to collect or remit sales tax. So less than $5,000 in annual sales, you can see that had on the state budget, that had an effect of about $1 million, and it was probably costing us quite a bit just to process all that. And so this was a little bit of the idea, let's take some burden off and make things work easier. And a small seller in Idaho doesn't have to deal with the tax commission, doesn't have to collect it and then send it on to the state. Food tax credit increase. So we will be seeing that in our next tax filing year, our tax credit will go from $120 per year to $155 per year per person. And so that means for a family of four, and we don't no longer have an age distinction in Idaho. It's just all Idahoans. If you're an Idaho resident and filing taxes, or if you're not required to file, you can still file one pager and get that money. But a family of four in Idaho would receive $155 times four for sales tax. And so that equates to $10,300 worth of tax groceries that you buy tax-free. And so I think that's kind of getting there. That's not how much we spend at the grocery store. That's probably getting close to how much we spend on actual groceries, if we think about the things at the grocery store that are groceries and what's not. We could probably still adjust it upward. But you can see that raising that $35 per individual, that reduces state money by $50 million. So there's $50 million less to work with for the things that we take care of as a state, whether schools, prisons, parks, whatever we're doing, roads. And then, so $50 million less there, and then down here we did $100 million. Remember I said up here we talked about 100 total originally for the splitting at 50-50 between income and property. We did 253 income, and then we did $100 million in property tax. And that's $50 million going into a property tax relief fund and $50 million going into a school program that helps school districts pay back their bonds. So those numbers over here are a lot bigger than what the original budget proposal was. And then if we come down here, you can see what these decisions forced us into some other decisions. So because we didn't have as much money available up here, then we were planning on putting $40 million into a fire fund for wildfire. We did zero. So normally what we've been doing historically is at the end of the year, we pay our wildfire bill. We come into session in January, and we look back from the previous summer and we pay that bill. And the bill last year was $60 million. And so the proposal was to pay the 60 like we always do. And then actually we were going to start to get ahead and just put $40 million as kind of the average over time. So we would put $40 million into the fund every year in advance and just let the fund balance ride a little bit. And instead what we did was of the $60 million that we owed from last summer, we paid $40 million of it with money on hand, and we paid the last $20 million out of the checkbook, out of the balance, drew the fund balance down because we had forced ourselves into this situation. There was a proposal to transfer $15 million into a program for workforce housing. That didn't happen. Public Education Stabilization Fund, we always add some money into that. The $50 million did not happen. We have a rainy day savings account. These are both rainy day. Stabilization fund is rainy day savings. We were going to put another $59 million into the general fund rainy day account, and we didn't do that because we had already made these other commitments where we'd reduce the amount of money we had to work with. So you can see that cutting taxes does have an impact as to what we can do. And so we moved away from some of our traditional Idaho conservative actions we take, and that was because we forced ourselves into that with that income tax cut. I think that the...
Jim?
Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So I just want to make sure I'm not misunderstanding. So the wildfire fund, we don't have any money to fight wildfires, or we just didn't replenish the fund, so we're going to drain it?
There is still some money in the fund, but we didn't. We paid the bill from last year, but we, instead of paying for it with money out of this year's budget, we paid for 2/3 of it with money out of this year's budget, and we pulled some money out of that fund. So there is still balance there. And that system is actually called what's known as a deficiency warrant. That's that system where we come in and pay the bill. It's like having a credit card, and we come in and pay it at the end of the year. But we were trying to get ahead and paying with a debit card, and we didn't do it because we couldn't.
Thank you.
Yep. So this next slide shows you, I'll preface this by saying, you know, many of the legislators going in, we know what the discussions are. The discussions at home, we're talking about what bothers people is the property tax, because it's the one tax you don't really control, right? You get to choose how much you pay in income tax, because you can choose how much you're going to make. You get to choose how much you're going to pay in sales tax, because you can buy more or less. But this property tax just comes in, and it seems to be a challenge more and more for folks who are, especially as you get into the retirement years, and you have your retirement figured at one with certain expenditures, and when they're taken off on property tax. So we came in, many of us were hoping to try and work on a solution on property tax. Instead, we did much more on income tax. But you can see for a family of four at median income, which is $90,000, it's $240 a year. So it really doesn't have that much of an impact on the most of us by reducing income tax. But it certainly has an effect on what we can do at the state level. Yeah, we got a question back here.
Yeah, regarding the property tax, it seems to me that one of the big problems that I've been noticing, especially in Bonner County, and I don't know about the other areas, is the manner in which property is assessed for taxes. So, for example, we had a parcel of ground that was worth so much, and it was assessed at probably more than twice what it ever would have sold for, comparatively speaking, for the properties around it. And I thought, okay, I understand that you have to kind of get sort of an average of what it is you've got in an area, but this was just so overblown and so overinflated that it was beyond belief. And there's a very small window for people to complain about it or to challenge it. And so it seems to me that that's a part of the problem when it comes to property taxes. It's not so much, I mean, I'm not suggesting it's not so much necessarily that they need to be looked at, but I think also just the general assessment somehow needs to be looked at. Is it actually reflective of what a person's parcel is, property is actually worth? Because I think that that's causing a lot of people's problems. So that's just my comment.
Thank you.
But all the little details do matter. And this year we made some changes to the, not the assessment formula, but the fallback system that we use if people can't pay their taxes, so they can, I'm trying to think of the name. But there's a few systems for circuit breakers. So we do look at dates and times and reporting. And that always can be improved. Okay, I'd like to think that it doesn't need very much improvement, but the reality is we'll get a message from some of the county clerks and say, hey, you know what, we need to change. If we change the date to where it's a little more aligned with something else, it would help. So any feedback you have on that, I'm all ears. I think I'll just say for Jim and I both, I thought we were going to be able to change the homeowner's exemption this year. And there was a considerable effort to do that that ran aground. We had no success doing that. We've also talked about trying to average out things with the assessments. So there's a number of ways you can deal with it, but you need to get some traction. And you know, you write bills, and that has something to do with the number of bills. A lot of bills are written, and they're a dead end. Unless you can sell it and get it heard in a tax and rev committee, for instance, then it's a dead end. So anyway, it continues to kind of drive you crazy. It's like we want to make some improvements to property tax, but this year there was just no appetite for it. So, yes, sir. Go ahead, Chief. You can.
I know we just got done talking about bringing things in from other states, and I'm not proposing to do that at all, but I didn't realize this was such an issue, so I started going out in the community and talking with people about a levy and what that means to them and the concerns they have with that. You know, there's a limit to our budget, but there doesn't seem to be a limit to how much people can raise, so I was just curious, and talking to you, I know you know this, but like something like a Prop 13, is that something that ever's been discussed, like a Prop 13 solution?
Yes, Idaho did pass something similar to that. It was a citizens initiative some many years ago, Prop 1, essentially, or Citizens Initiative 1. We have a constitutional obligation to treat all taxpayers equally, and so that was ruled unconstitutional. We could change the Constitution to do something, but there is more and more talk of how to take care of people, especially as you go on to fixed income and older, and that property tax becomes such a challenge. Yes.
Years ago, property taxes in Bonner County, for the most part, were based on a fair, equitable market value. That's what has changed over the years, is the market value. While we've all sold some of our homes for a nice profit, and things have gone up, that side of it has never been really addressed, I don't think, very well, because fair market value is not fair for property taxpayers anymore. And the 1% initiative was based on 1% of fair market value. Well, we don't have fair market value anymore. Is there any anything in the works to look at creating if you will, some form of fair market valuation? That's when we were stable in the 70s and 80s when I was working at my job teaching it. And it seemed to work, and everybody was reasonably happy with the 1%. But now 1% of an inflated number pushes a lot of us out of the norm.
So I might have a little bit of homework to do to understand exactly what you're referring to from earlier years, but the connection I make here, that Mark mentioned there was interest in the homeowner's exemption, and the homeowner's exemption was something that we got ourselves as citizens of Idaho through the Citizens Initiative process, and when that Citizens Initiative was first passed here in the state of Idaho, it was the amount that was put on that was roughly half of the median value of half of the value of a home, median value, and or up to 50% of. So that if you had something less, you didn't get a huge homeowner's exemption, but you got up to. And I'm not sure if I quite said that clearly. But the original Citizens Initiative, I believe the intent of that was that half the value of your home should be exempt from taxation. That's how it was first put on the plate, and it's nowhere near that now. That's right, and that's why we've been pushing, because
I think that the, I don't remember what the original number was, maybe 80,000 or something like that, but that was what the half of the value of a home. And right now, the what's the average value, or I'm interchanging median and average, but homes are worth $450,000. That's like the middle of the range. Of course, we know they're much more expensive homes. And the homeowner's exemption is $125,000. That's why we're interested in pushing that homeowner's exemption up. So here's where the challenge comes in change in the homeowner's exemption. We have four categories of real estate: residential, commercial, timber, and ag. And the residential portion is the only group of folks who are not represented by regular lobby groups in the Capitol. So we're the only people there lobbying for the homeowner's exemption. And but if you think of commercial, ag, and timber, they have people in the Capitol who come in. I mean, that's, and there's no problem with that, but that's the result, is that the commercial property owners are very much interested in not changing the homeowner's exemption, because that does shift tax onto them. But I can tell you the trend line over time is that, with especially with the residential values, we've seen it escalate so fast here in Idaho, and in Sandpoint in particular, I think, that the residential home values are going up faster than other types of land. And so then residential picks up more of the burden of property tax. The share, their slice of the pie, the slice of the pie for residential becomes bigger. And the only, and one way to bring that back in line is to raise the homeowner's exemption. So that's, we have that mechanism in place. I think it's the fastest one to get at, is to continue to push and try and get the homeowner's exemption raised up. Hi, Molly.
Hi. I appreciate your concern for affordable housing. And the homeowner's exemption, I think, does help make homeowning affordable, but it doesn't help people who rent, because they, you don't have a category. There's commercial, but there's not rental housing. And so maybe by, with the homeowner's exemption, we're throwing more onto those who rent, and they too need some relief. And I'm not saying don't do the homeowners, but I think we need rentals to be affordable, and that needs to maybe look at our tax system in some way.
Thank you, Molly. I had a long conversation on that just a day or two ago, so I appreciate that, because that's on my mind. Todd?
Yeah. If I could add one thing to the conversation, and that is the counties in the state have assessors, and they assess the property. And the state also has assessors. So what the state, and people may not know this, so that's why I'm bringing it up. The state will come in and assess, and they'll look at what the county has assessed. And if they don't think the county has assessed enough, for instance, they will add, they will force the county to raise the taxes. That happened in Bonner County in 2006. They came in and the county apparently had underassessed, and the state says that's not what we want. So taxes went up as a result of that state assessment. So they keep things in a band of assessment in order to protect their side, the state, as far as property tax.
Thank you for that. We actually acted on that this year. He's talked about a band, and so the state tax commission looks to make sure that assessments are plus or minus 10% of what they view as market value, and that now is plus or minus 5%. So that band got tightened up this year, so hopefully, but it, the effect can be the state forcing a taxing a county to change their values. But he's got one back. You want it, Mark?
Sure. Yeah. This is a little bit of switching gears, but your thoughts on House Bill 93, the $50 million for school choice, do you expect that that's going to increase like it has in other states, the amount of money for school choice?
Yes, yes, and yes. in all the other in the state, the states that I've studied, Arizona, Indiana, and others, yes, it's increased considerably, and it's increased considerably quickly. Before we walked out of the Capitol this session, there was already talk about how we can increase the amount of money that's set aside for House Bill 93 for next year. That was already discussed. So I would anticipate we will hear all about it. There's also a number of things that have come up about it, that private schools will generally increase their tuition based on more public dollars being available to add to the inflation of it. A lot of it, you know, we just have to wait and see what happens. But the other states, you're exactly right. The cost just continues to rise, and we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. But yes, sir. Gray?
Right. So doesn't that play back into the property tax issues, seeing as so much of the levy is so much of the property tax goes to school school funding, that if the state supports less, puts less money into the public education fund, then that's the mill rate, that's part of the mill rate for property taxes.
I'll take some of it. It's complicated. There's the $50 million was not directly pulled from public education, but it's pulled from everywhere else. So it's still money. It still takes money away from roads, public safety, you name it. So that takes it away. But there's another consequence of this, and that is the number of kids that switch over and go to private school, because of the formula that we have now for how we pay for education, there will be less dollars available for schools because of their enrollment will go down. If you think about it, one, it's not the same, but it's similar. West Bonner, when they went through all of their troubles over the last couple of years, I think at least 10% of their kids have left wherever. I think some have come here to Sandpoint. Others have moved on to other areas, but that is a direct hit on the school district, because that's 100 or 10% less revenue they get based on average daily attendance.
Thank you. I don't know if you can hear me. Back to the school funding. I don't think it's a secret that Idaho doesn't fund schools anywhere near what other states do in our country. In fact, I believe we're rated one of the lowest. With the voucher program now that's been initiated, and you're saying it will take money away from public school, what can be done about that? And how are we supposed to run our schools and have decent buildings and hire good teachers without money?
Well, this is probably a great time to point out that there is a petition in the back of the room available for people to sign, to urge your legislators to make sure we keep the expense in line. But your question is, how do we make sure we prioritize? And it comes down to talking with legislators and pushing that idea that the way I've always looked at this, we have a constitutional obligation. We've said, we agreed more than 100 years ago that we would have a public education system. There's really not a prohibition on this tax credit, but there is, it does take away from. And so if we haven't met our obligation, I think the legislature has been in the Supreme Court, determined by the Supreme Court twice to not be meeting that obligation, or maybe three times now. So that's, you know, I voted no against House Bill 93 because I think we need to meet our basic obligation first. Some of this again is outside influence. There are legislators, I will say, that who definitely believe in what happened in the policy. Obviously, there was a majority vote in that direction, and they believe that we should be doing this. But many were influenced by there was a lot of money that came into this, because when you're the more money available in those schools, the more curriculum there is to sell. There are contracts out there to be had as a result of this tax credit. And that's where the money starts to flow.
I'm an independent voter, kind of a rare breed these days, but I want to commend you both for having the courage to speak up against the Central Committee and to represent the people, and also to speak up about the outside money and to continue to point that out, because it's real important. I also have a suggestion about, it seems like maybe there should be a public education tax simply for public education. Maybe add to the income tax. I don't like paying more taxes, but if there was a tax that everybody paid, then property taxes wouldn't be so high because they wouldn't be carrying so many levies.
So I can share with you that essentially we are, there is that tax because the general fund is sales tax and income tax, but then there's a policy decision made at the legislature every year as to how much. And that's where the challenge is. Look at, we heard about 2006 a little bit. And one of the other, the big changes in 2006 with property taxes going up, is 2006 is referred to as the Idaho property tax revolt. So there was an emergency session where the legislature went down to Boise in the middle of the summer, and House Bill 1 of 2006 added one penny to the sales tax. That's when we went from 5% to 6%, but at the same time took off the school line item from property taxes because of such the challenge. And then the real history of it, or you know, part of this, how did we end up here, is that then we had a recession in 2008 that was really drastic. And if you look at the what we had to do with school funding and state, if you remember 2009 and 10 and 11, some of the state parks were closed. We really had some tough decisions. I still remember well that the governor's chief of staff from those years told me, when I got to know him in more recent times, he said every day we came in and had to find $1 million to cut. That was, you know, on the average, that was what they were doing, was cutting $1 million a day out of the budget. And so we ended up not funding the schools to an adequate level, and it's taken us many years. It took until about 2015 or 16 to get back on trajectory, and we're still trying to catch up with some of that. So we do have income tax and sales tax that are available as the general fund, but it's always that policy decision, the prioritization. Right. And that's it. So yeah, that's, but you'd still have to make a decision, I guess, as to, are you going to use all of that tax? It still would be an appropriation every year. And so I don't think that, I mean, if you dedicated a certain 1 cent, like that was the agreement in 2006, was that 1 cent was for education, but it wasn't dedicated to. So you could build up a fund, and maybe that would make it easier, but then the legislature always has the ability to take any money from any fund and do anything with it. And so I don't know that. Yeah.
I've been studying education for a number of years, along with everybody else. And I've always said and maintained that Idaho is better off ranking-wise than it appears on those charts that we're 49th and 48th. Would you agree that some of those other states are using their monies for building purposes, when it's always been a historical thing in Idaho that most of our buildings and that was always to be funded locally by individual districts, and those monies are not built into that ranking system? How do we compare with other states when we have that unique situation?
Well, a couple of numbers I want to share, and then I'll hand it over to you. I think we fund at the lowest level per student in the country, but we do perform middle pack. So we're doing well with our student performance. Now, if we spend a little bit more, maybe we could be at the top of the rankings. In funding per student. But performance-wise, we're about 24 or 23. And when you look at standardized testing, the students are in the middle. But you're right, and we could do more, and that's I've advocated for that. I think you know that. Just a couple years ago, we did take for the state of Idaho for the first time, we as a state of Idaho delved into funding schools, and so the legislature made a commitment and bonded over $1 billion and handed that out. It was a 10-year program. You could take the payments in per year for 10 years or up front. All of the districts took them up front. And so that meant the school district here got about $16 million. West Bonner got $4 million. Boundary County got $5 million. I think Boundary County, you'll see an expansion that will be partially funded by that here at the high school and some more career technical education programs. Boundary County is working really hard to use the money they receive plus some other mechanisms and then hopefully a small bond then because they've not been able to pass a bond for construction of a new Valley View Elementary. But I think with a three-tiered approach, they're going to, I hope it will see soon that they'll announce that they're going to construct a new elementary school that was built from used bricks from Farragut.
My question really was, how does it compare nationwide
per student?
Are those other states using their money for buildings, building that into their, quote, larger number than Idaho? I've always said Idaho does better than, I hate to sound like that since I was a teacher, but Idaho does a little better than we maybe think we do.
I don't know those numbers. If you look at the overalls, including construction, I don't know that answer.
And I don't know the numbers the way you're speaking of them either. I'm grateful that our performance is higher than our funding. But facility-wise, you know, this year I think we passed a $50 million emergency fund for school districts that they can apply for. For boiler repair and for other things. Will that fix all the facility issues? No, it will not. But we put another $50 million out there for school districts like Salmon or for like Troy down near Moscow that had to rebuild a school that had an emergency. So we keep trying to come up with unique ways to fund facilities, and it's a bugger, I'll tell you that. There's just the other
states do.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
Another piece of this is, you know, we look at it from Bonner County or Boundary County. We do have other counties in our state that are mostly agricultural that to pass a school bond puts the burden of a new school on a couple hundred farmers, and it may be family farmers, not corporate farmers. So the makeup of the counties really and the school districts makes a big difference as well. So it's not like you can tax, you know, 50,000 homeowners on it and also business owners. Sometimes that goes to where it's really just a pretty small population. So that's another thing. The other thing is it's the makeup of the people that are in the Capitol. If we have a very anti-tax makeup in the Capitol and that, you know, like Jim said earlier, the Gang of Eight saying that we will not agree to any kind of a tax increase, it's tough to get something like that passed. We ran a
representative part of the Gang of Eight?
No, if you're asking about the District 1, not that I know of. The District, the Gang of Eight is made up of mostly people from the Treasure Valley. So that's it. But they take their own oaths to each other, and they stake out how they will vote, and they hold to it. So that's where we're at. That'll do it. Okay.
So I just wanted to summarize this slide, and then we'll go on. But what we're saying here is a policy question for you. $400 million less to work with in the state for some of the things that we know we need to take care of because the state's growing. Or do we cut the income tax, and then this is – there's a little bit extra money in your pocket. So that's kind of the question mark. Share those thoughts with us anytime. But that was the point of the slide, was the impact on the individual versus the impact on what we do as a state. And point out to like something like this we saw happen this year. So this is a tax increase essentially, because this child tax credit was put in place in 2018 and it had an expiration or a sunset date, and we didn't act upon it to extend it. And so that was one other tax piece that happened this year, is that the child tax credit that people with young children were receiving and are not receiving anymore. So we just had a header here talk about wildfire. That was something that I worked on quite a bit this year. You know, I serve on the Northern Lights. We have a question?
Yes.
Oh, sorry, Kate.
I have kind of a burning question of why in the world did they have vote on a $400 million tax relief? So now we're in this bind with all these problems.
The Speaker of the House really advocated for that. He is really driven to reduce income tax. That's his thought process. And so we're now, our income tax in Idaho is at 5.3%. The income tax, since 2017, we've reduced the income tax five times. I was there for three of those times. I voted yes twice, but at the second time I voted yes, I said we need to make sure we're meeting our obligations as the population grows. And the reason we're, you know, the argument that's presented is that, gosh, there's more and more tax money coming in, so we can cut the tax rate. The reason there's more tax money coming in is because it's a sales tax and income tax are an indication of what's going on out there, how many cars are driving down the road, and how many people are working. And there's a lot more going on in the state. And to keep up with that, we need to have more revenue. That's not raising the tax rate. I was advocating for keeping the tax rate the same. It generates more money, because every time somebody buys something, that's some more sales tax, and every time somebody's out working. And so you would expect that the tax revenues will increase even when you leave the tax rate alone. So the argument has been, let's cut the tax rate. We're saying we're going to wear out the farm and then wonder why we can't feed ourselves. That's how I view that. And so I voted yes for two tax cuts, and then I voted no on the tax cut this year, because it is challenging to try and meet the obligations that I think we have. So wildfire, across the West, you've seen wildfires becoming more difficult and challenging. I've definitely been up current on that as a board member for Northern Lights Electric Co-op. And I'm also a board member for the Idaho Consumer-Owned Utilities, which is all the co-ops around the state who come together. And just like the chief talked about, some of the insurance companies are walking away. Well, so are they're also walking away from our electric utilities. And so we wanted to get in place something to prevent the scenario. We didn't want to limit the liability in regards to actual damages. And so the bill that we passed this year that I sponsored, if your house burns down because the electric utility started a fire and your house burned down, then you're going to be compensated for that. But if it's not the utility, and the utility was not doing anything negligent, right, you can be out there and a fire can start. But with the scenario is over in on the other side of Spokane, where the equipment was worn out and it started a fire because the equipment broke. But if your equipment meets all the standards, Mother Nature blows through and knocks over your brand new equipment, should you deal with your own homeowner's insurance, or should you expect the electric utility? And so that was this bill, just trying to decipher ahead of time where the liability is, because what's gone on in California, those fires, you bankrupt the utility. You don't have a choice to go, and you can't go to another grocery store. The utility is a regulated monopoly, and so that just means when
when your neighbor moves to the Bahamas because their house burned in and you're burned and they took emotional damages and got paid for emotional damages, you're going to be stuck with it as the ratepayer, right? And so that's what we were trying to deal with. So that's what that wildfire bill is. We saw, as we were passing this bill through the legislature, we saw in Oregon, 4 years ago there was a fire, 2 years ago there was a court settlement, and that company has already paid out more than $400 million in damages. And so at the two-year point, they started making payments based on jury decisions. And then 2 years after that, just a month or two ago, the Oregon Department of Fire said, actually, the utility was not responsible. There were other fires nearby, and the wind blew embers over, and it was not the utility at all. So that's what we're trying to get at. That's the kind of case. So that's what the wildfire bill is, and that passed this year. Then the intent is to protect you as the ratepayer, and so that the utilities can continue to operate. So Mark can talk about the next one.
Sure. Women's health exception. We all know the labor and delivery unit at Bonner General closed a couple years ago. We've had a reduction in OBGYN coverage, just lots of different associated problems with our healthcare system here and across the state. I worked with a doctor down in Boise, stayed in connection with doctors here, and Jim and I actually we introduced it in the Senate side, a women's health exception for abortion, essentially. I think what's interesting is the challenge of getting something like that passed in the Capitol. It's clearly a very pro-life place, but we've had a considerable number of judicial decisions that have come down in support of essentially a women's health exception. And then April 11th, another medical decision supporting doctors making good decisions on women's health care. So what Jim and I are trying to do is we're saying, great, memorialize it, put it down, write it down so doctors can have some comfort in doing what they've been educated, trained, and they have the experience to do. So it's nothing that's necessarily earth-shaking, but it is earth-shaking for our doctors, for them to have some comfort in state statute and not buried in a Supreme Court decision somewhere that would take quite a bit of legal money to try and defend themselves. So we introduced it towards the end of the session. It was just introduced at Senate Bill 1184, but it caused quite a stir just the morning that we did it. That's one of my projects this summer, is to work on tweaking that and seeing if we can't get it introduced and getting it to where we get a full hearing on it. It's supported by our medical community, but Jim and I did it really independently of everybody else. District 1's had enough impacts that I felt very comfortable bringing it forward, just saying this is hurting our district and it needs to be straightened out. So that was that.
Just to be clear, this is women's health exception. We're not talking about elective abortion. We're talking about those cases where medical treatment is necessary to save the life, as it now reads, or we would like it to say the health of the mother. It's a tough conversation, right? That's why there's so much back and forth on this, consternation and contention. We really have a challenge here where, again, we're at the bottom of the list. We have fewer doctors per capita than any state in the country, and right now the doctors will tell you they're not comfortable. And these are professionals who spent 12 to 15 years in education and training, and a lot of that is risk management. And I think when they come to look at their own lives and the risk management for their families, they're not comfortable as the law reads now. And we want to make sure that we can keep those doctors here, and of course we want to be able to take care of women who are in a situation that's and just unfortunate. So.
And then moving on, we ran a bill, EMS, a couple of EMS bills, and it was interesting. You would think tweaking and changing the way we deliver emergency medical services to across the state would not be something that would be very political. But I have to tell you, on the floor of the House, there were multiple questions about taxing, and then how, if we make changes to our EMS system, how will this impact our taxes, and how will we be taxed additionally over this? So I think mostly it'll, if we do make changes, it'll be actually more fee-for-service stuff. But that was a monumental change to move health, our emergency medical services out of health and welfare and move it to the military division, a more emergency-minded agency, so we can get some better support for it there. We ran the fire consolidation bill. The only thing I will say about that is I worked on that for about 18 months to get a two-page bill passed. We finally did it, but I know one thing's been said out and about that I want to clarify. And if you read the bill, House Bill 208, it's very clear there's an appeal process in it. So no taxes will be added to anyone's bill without actually all their elected fire board officials working on it. So there's local control there. And then if anything, the residents can appeal it and have it go to a vote of the people. But the consolidation is really more about efficiency of two agencies or more, and not about it's not about adding to anybody's tax bill. So, and then last, the 911 system. Statewide, we have about 40 answer points for 911. As I understand it, we have about one that's really next gen, which means really it accepts cell phone calls properly and as they should. So statewide, they're looking at our 911 system, and it'll look like next year we'll try and make some wholesale changes to how that system works, so the systems can work in back and forth. We don't have drop calls. We don't have calls sent to Canada. We just need to do some work on ours. So that's some good homework over the summer.
I haven't told Mark yet, but I just got asked to be on the committee for the 911 bit. So I'll be that next gen of dealing with cellular systems versus hardline systems and how that plays out. I went down to Post Falls a few weeks ago with Sheriff Stoley out of Boundary County and Sheriff Wheeler out of Bonner County. We were in Post Falls and got my first introduction into the topic, and then by chance got asked to serve on the committee here at the statewide level. So we'll be working on that. And that's kind of a lead into the next slide. I think we can both talk a little bit about, you know, what are we doing? What do we do during the off session? We said that nominally we're in Boise for 3 months for the legislative session. So then we both are on different interim committees and then get asked to do different things. So the Senate concurrent resolution. So we had a resolution started in the Senate that went through the House and it was concurred in the House, or excuse me, went through the Senate and concurred in the House. The Land Use and Housing Study Committee, and this is really about housing affordability and how do these topics affect housing affordability. So we're going to take a look at that and see if we need to make, what ideas are out there. Montana has done some in this area, so we'll look at what they did. We'll talk with everybody here and see if we should do something, because that's always the first question. Should we change the law to help out here, state law? And I got asked if I would be on the committee, and then I found out I was asked to run the committee. So since I'm from Sandpoint, we have four meetings, but we're going to make one of them here. So in August, we'll be here in the Sandpoint City Council chambers, and we'll do a meeting down in Boise, one in Idaho Falls, come up here, and then go back to Boise. So that's the Land Use and Housing Study Committee. The Legislative Council on River Governance, same thing happened. I got asked to be on it, and we know we have a lot of concern with our both Albany Falls Dam, the gate repairs, as well as our lake water levels. This is a group that is Idaho, Oregon, Montana, Washington, and this happens to be Idaho's year to sponsor
to be the sponsor of a meeting, and so they put me in charge, and we're going to have the meeting in Sandpoint. So we're going to be here in October, talking about rivers throughout our Northwest system, but we'll make sure we get some focus on what we have going on here. River governance, and the Kootenai is particularly interesting, right, because it starts in Canada, comes through Montana, comes through Idaho, and goes back to Canada, and then it comes back so it definitely is a big part of the Columbia River system. Yep. In fact, I think I'm going to put on the agenda, we're going to go up and take a look at the hatchery. So it's good to be in charge, you get to set the agenda. And we're also on a resource committee this summer, and found out just recently on the 911 next gen transition. Seems like there are the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee. We go out a couple times a year and go around the state and see where we're spending that money. And so we'll be doing that. Idaho Falls in May and coming up here soon. And then hope to be up here in Sandpoint in the fall with the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee. But I'm not in charge of that one, so I have to ask nicely. Oh, and then Mark can talk about some of these other efforts.
And then I'm on the Permanent Building Fund, so Tuesday I'll be in Pocatello for a couple of days to look at state facilities down there, and that's what we do. We spend money and allocate money for different building, either construction or improvements. So we go around the state as well in the off season. We all know we have issues with the Albany Falls Dam and the pond and Lake Pondere, and then most recently with Springy Point's campground. So I'll be in Boise on Monday to talk with other state people. We're doing everything we can, from talking to our federal counterparts, to our state, to our state parks and rec, to water resources. We're doing an economic impact study right now through U of I. My guess is this year we'll be having U of I staff do a hydrology study on our lake to look at the water use as well as the power generation. And we'll keep poking the bear. So there's lots of different ideas. I wish I had a clear path forward that can say we're gonna get this squared away. I know I can speak for myself and say it's extremely frustrating to have to go to some of the meetings and listen to them and know that some of this is out of our hands. But I talk almost daily. I'm working on either calling somebody in the federal contingent or writing some letters or doing some report work, or like I said, this Monday I'll meet with the governor and talk to him about it. But we've got to continue to push on this. The timeline for repairs just is not acceptable, nor is it understandable. But we're going to keep working on it. So, yes, Patricia.
Federal Electrical Regulation Commission to tell California to find its own power. We're funding 51% of the peak power in LA out of Grand Coulee. And that's why we have a problem with lake levels.
So what she's referring to is that the Bonneville Power Association, which is our power marketing agency, they sell the electricity from all of the big dams along the Columbia River, as the Lower Snake River dams, Albany Falls, all these, and the nuclear plant out in the Tri-Cities. All of those generating plants make up the Columbia River, Columbia system, or the BPA system. And that BPA system is capable of generating close to 12,000 megawatts. The latest numbers I have are about 12,000 megawatts. And the system is designed for the people of the Northwest, but the way that system is sized right now, the BPA we negotiated with, I should back up a little bit more. We signed 20-year contracts with BPA as our electric co-ops to buy that power, because the residents of the Northwest are entitled to that low-cost hydropower. And so we're coming up on 2028 contracts. So we've been in negotiations with the Bonneville Power Administration as to what our rates will be. And part of that is knowing how much energy is available, and that the Bonneville Power System for our tier one, for our rates, our low rates for the people of the Northwest is sized, was sized at 7,000. I think we talked them into 7,250 megawatts, but there's more available there. And so what Patricia's referring to is that that excess power, we can buy the tier two power, but it's at a higher rate, but it can also be sold on the market. And so some of that power is going out on the market elsewhere. We benefit from that in one way, that it's sold at a higher rate, so that keeps our rates lower. But there's a back and forth conversation there. Would be better off just to keep it all here and not have to go look for other generation sources when we have more available through Bonneville Power. So that's what that conversation is about. Any other questions? I must have bored the heck out of you with that one. Steve.
And the bike thing that goes underneath Lignite, not Lignite Road, but
Bottle Bay Road.
Years ago it was Lignite Road for some reason. Anyway, that's been a big improvement, I think, when I see the bicyclists and the hikers not have to worry about crossing that road. And then the thing that you helped or were the catalyst for with the turnaround coming off of Lakeshore Drive, I think that's been a good addition. So I wanted to compliment both of you probably for that.
Appreciate that, Steve. That that turnaround from that provides a safe option for turnaround. I wish everybody were using it, because I still see a lot. I wish it were a little bit further north, but it's still only 3/4 mile, and 3/4 mile or less is not too far to go for safety. And especially as we turn into the summer season, hopefully we can get everybody going that way. You can see the difference on the roads. You can tell the weather by looking at the highway. You could have a blinder on and not be able to see the sky, but if the highway's full, right? I mean, as soon as the sun comes out and it gets nice like yesterday, you can see that traffic on the highway. So it's summertime. It's going to be crowded. Hopefully people will use that. Mayor Eskridge is asking the question, what's the difference between the Idaho Freedom Foundation and the Idaho Freedom Caucus? It is two groups of people. There was a splinter in the members of the Freedom Foundation, which had grown to quite a membership, but there are different people involved now. And so there's a group of folks who are still with the Freedom Foundation and that scoring system we've seen, and what's been around for a decade or so or more now. And then another group broke off, the Idaho Freedom Caucus. And so I don't think those groups see eye to eye, but they're still, I don't know how to characterize which one's further right or not, but.
Well, given that definition, they're both bad.
So the payment for the Albany Falls Gates was predetermined. The Bonneville Power Administration sells the electricity. The Army Corps of Engineers operates the facility. And there's a contract written between the two of them that Bonneville Power Association will pay 97.5% of those type of repairs. So there's been this conversation about, hey, do we need to get more money? Do we need to get a federal appropriation? And it's only 2.5% that the Army Corps has to come up with. The other part is there in the bank, ready to go. The challenge, or my take on the gate repair right now, is that one, they decided to redesign the gates, and I see that. I would probably want to at least take a look at it, but if I were rebuilding something of that magnitude, but. Those gates lasted 70 years. I think they probably were designed to last 50. The flaw in those was a manufacturing defect, not a not a design flaw. And so I think that we could have just gone and built more gates. And I just don't think there's a sense of urgency. You know, there's a declaration that we're operating under constraints or essentially an emergency situation in what they're doing with the operation of the dam, but at the same time, no sense of urgency in getting these gates replaced. The good thing is that the initial timeline I saw was 20 years to get all those gates replaced. We're down to 6 now, which is only one more year than it took to build the entire dam. But we'll keep working on them.
So I have a federal question, I guess, and I don't know that you've got any insight into it or not. Mark, you can try to answer it, maybe. I don't know. Has there been any scuttlebutt with regard to the proposed VA cuts? What's the fate of the Sandpoint VA clinic? Is there any, have you had any scuttlebutt at all about that?
I haven't heard anything about it, Gray.
We wore you out on Saturday.
No, I have a question here for you. There's a specter of a looming recession coming in, and you were talking about the impact to public schools in the last, what was it, 2006, you were saying? 2008. Is there any sort of a stopgap planning to address the looming recession coming?
Yeah, so we've put ourselves in a good place again in Idaho. And when we went into 2008, we had those rainy day funds built up to a pretty high level. And we did a combination of the state, I wasn't involved at the time, but cut expenditures, and at the same time, over the course of 3 years, drained down the rainy day funds. And then since then, we've had to build those back up. We're just slightly higher than we were. When we went into the recession, I think we had about 16 or 18% of annual expenditures in the rainy day funds, and we're just over 20% now. So we have rainy day funds at a great level. I said we were trying to add to them. That's because the budget goes up every year, and so we need to add a little bit to keep us at that same percentage, and so that's what we were trying to do. So we're in a pretty good position. As a whole, with the general fund the general fund budget stabilization fund, the public education stabilization fund, and a list of others, we have about $1.2 billion to work with in reserve, but that's on a our budget every year is a total of around, this year is a total of about $14 billion, and our general fund budget is in the $6 billion range, and that's where that 20% is a percentage of the general fund. So the general fund is our Idaho dollars. We have a lot of other federal money, particularly in the health and welfare department, that comes through the state, and we have to appropriate it, but we don't have reserve funds for that. That's the federal government function administered by the state of Idaho. But we do, short answer, yeah, we're in a pretty good spot with the rainy day funds.
Are they in the stock market?
No. That, if they were, they'd be underwater. George.
Well, you know what my Idaho Association of Cities score is, don't you? I'm like number 2 in the House. So I'm really proud of that. Yeah, from the top, not the bottom. So I'm really, and I've even, the primary lobbyist for the cities is a former representative, Kelly Packer. And I even sent an email to her when I saw the score that they sent me, which I don't usually look at scores much, but regardless, I saw it, and I went, oh, I wonder where I'm at. And I asked her, I said, are you sure this is right? I said, I never consider myself to be a champion for really anybody other than my district. And she said, no, she said, and to add to it, you brought legislation that the cities really liked, the EMS stuff and fire. And so anyway, and some other purchasing issues. So anyway, so I'm proud to represent our cities because that's what we should be doing. And it makes me feel good, and I love to get calls from George. So.
Well, I would say, only Kelly, and you both are appreciated by our group of cities that I know, because you try to do what the right thing is, regardless of the speaker or not.
We vote. I like to say you vote for your district, and that's my comfort level. Doesn't matter what the speaker says. Sometimes he's not real happy with me, but. Regardless, you vote for your district and you just let it go.
And I'd like to second that for the town hall that you held this session as well.
Hi, guys.
Yes, sir.
I have a question about Albany Falls. I mean, not Albany Falls, about Springy Point and the Cleed and those closures. Can the state step in and fund that? Or is like, is it take so long with the Army Corps of Engineers where they just say, sorry, it's just the way it is.
TBD, to be determined. Thursday, I spent 3 hours touring all of the Corps facilities on the river.
And are they all on the chopping block?
No, the Albany Falls, let's see, it's called Albany Cove is the campground and the beach area down at the dam. That is supposed to stay open, and then Riley Creek will stay open as well. That's the plan right now. It's Springy Point, but we've already reached out to State Parks and Rec. Like I said, I took a tour those guys. That's what I spent time with Thursday, and I'll go back down. Our interest is to figure out how to make it work.
That's a possibility.
So, and then I've already reached out to our federal, Fulcher and Reisha's office as well, and talked to their staff. So anyway, it's a work in progress. I wish I had a good answer for you. I don't, but we're working on it.
The only question I had in there was that, is there a logistical problem with like the Army, like once the state has enough money, can you guys just step in and fund it? Or is there like a process that goes on and then it's like, oh, it didn't get done?
Well, one, it's federal property, so it's a right. big deal. Even just to put an operating agreement in place, I don't think would happen this year. That's my practical reality of it. But what we want to do is encourage, and you could call Senator Risch's or email to Senator Risch, Senator Crapo, or Congressman Fulcher and say, these are important to us. That's what we're going to do. We at the meeting the other night emphasized that pretty heavily to the Corps. Because they could look at different ways to at least Springy Point, for example, close the campground but maintain the boat access so people can launch their boat, right? Trestle Creek is already an unmanned boat launch with a beach, and so you could they can get a little more creative. We're going to continue to push them on that. How would we operate our state parks? I've been talking about general fund in here a lot tonight, which is income tax and sales tax. One other big collection of revenue in the state is dedicated funds. When you go in and when you pay the $10 for your park pass on your vehicle or you just go to the park, that's all money that stays in parks and recreation. That's a dedicated fund for parks and rec as compared to fish and game when you buy a deer tag. And so parks and rec operates dedicated fund. It pays for itself. Very little general fund dollars in that. And so, yes, could the state operate something like that without putting more tax burden on the individual taxpayer who doesn't use it? Yeah, sure could.
With the a potential recession came up, but we're also seeing a rescission in funds from the federal government. And you said health and welfare in the state is largely passed through federal funds, which probably are at least partially in danger right now. Is there any thought in the state for what we do if we start to lose massive federal funds in health and welfare, transportation, education, et cetera?
Our education budget is about 10% federally funded. So I have not heard of any federal cuts that will impact our state with Medicaid, with any of the health and welfare issues. To be determined if we have to act on that. We can always come back. You hate to work on what could happen when you just don't really know. So for the time being, we seem to be pretty sound. Thank you.
The comment was that PILT, which is payment in lieu of taxes, I think that PILT and SRS are both not coming through. So the county receives money because we have so much federal ground in the counties. Counties here in Idaho, counties receive money in lieu of the property taxes they would otherwise collect if that were private property. Yeah, I've heard that too, that money is not coming. I've made the comment oftentimes that money is subject to political winds. And so what I am hopeful of is a new Forest Service chief who used to be the Idaho Department of Lands director. So Tom Schultz is running the entire Forest Service program. And the Undersecretary of Agriculture, Mike Boren, is also from Idaho, from Salmon, Idaho. So we have two people right there in that. And I think you'll see there's been an announcement, and they're trying to work toward getting back to some middle ground on harvest on Forest Service ground, so that we're not just doing fire treatment, we're actually utilizing the resource and doing the fire treatment at the same time. I'm hopeful and optimistic about that. And for the reason that I think most people know, but when you have a federal timber sale off of federal ground, 25% of the revenue comes back to schools and roads and bridges, and that's where that PILT and SRS have been put in substitute as those federal timber sales declined for over the last 40 years. So if we can get those back to find the right spot there and then start to see some of that revenue from timber sales, that'd be great. Thanks for coming out. You guys are awesome. It's Saturday at 8:00.
Hey, one more thing. There's a whole bunch of cookies back here. You need to take some home.
Signing off now from Sandpoint Community Hall, that was State Senator Jim Woodward and State Representative Mark Souter, and a pretty full crowd in Community Hall that hung out for a little better than 2 hours here. Continuing on with our regularly scheduled programming, you're listening to Panhandle Community Radio, 88.5 KRFY.